Kenya, for many of us, was the beacon of hope in the troubled, huge continent of Africa. That was, of course, before the violence that followed the 2007 election. Just earlier this week, you might have seen that the International Criminal Court has accused six of Kenya's most powerful men of committing massive crimes, their quote, during that election crisis. Well, John Githongo, previously a government insider turned whistleblower, turned anti-corruption activist, says post-election violence was all too predictable if you looked at it closely. John Githongo made international headlines 5 years ago when he resigned from his cushy public service position, and he went on a self-imposed exile in London, then released one of the most damning reports about government corruption in Kenyan history. In 2008, he returned to Nairobi, and he now heads a grassroots advocacy organisation in Nairobi, Inuka, Kenya, that calls for the empowerment of disadvantaged groups. And he's been writing very interestingly about how Kenyan society puts itself back together. So, John Githongo, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be on the show.
Well, a lot of Australians certainly did visit Kenya. Can you tell me, how is Kenya now?
Well, there's a sense in which Kenya is very much what Kenya has always been. Kenyans are a very peaceful, happy, friendly people. However, underlying that, very powerful narratives of ethnic exclusion and political contradictions caused by historic difficulties to do with political and economic governance that are really defining what Kenya is right now. So Kenya has always been a very stable nation. For the first time in our history, we are now in a condition that I would describe as perpetual volatility as a result of the explosion of violence that we saw in 2007-2008.
Can we expect continuing volatility for the next few years, or is there some sense of some new models emerging?
I think we can expect the volatility to continue for the next few years. We've had political violence in Kenya before. The kind of violence that developed in 2007 had an element of turning into popular violence. In other words, it was an explosion of spontaneous, pent-up grievances and victimhood on the part of huge sections of the population, and that shakes you up. You know, it's a bit like a martini. You know, you get shooken up and stirred, and you're not very used to it. So volatility is going to be our condition for some time. We also have a whole range of governance balls up in the air at the same time. We've got a new constitution. We've had two constitutional referendums in the past 6 years. We've had an election which almost led to a meltdown. We've just redrawn all our boundaries. We're implementing devolved, almost federal kind of structure of government. All this is happening at the same time.
Could you help us to understand, though, underneath all of those legislative changes and formal changes, what about people's own temperament and sensibility? Like, obviously, you were all shocked, rigid by what happened. How are you putting Humpty Dumpty back together again?
The National Accord of March 2008 that ended the violence and led to the coalition government had a range of reforms that were to be implemented that included the constitutional reform process that we have just gone through. And the process of implementing that reform agenda is ongoing. And that's supposed to put Humpty Dumpty back again. However, I don't think we will ever put Humpty Dumpty back again. The kind of Kenya that is going to come out of this is going to be a very different creature.
The middle classes, you say in your piece, that in fact the Kenyan middle class is prone to a sort of exceptionalism. They really did think among all Africans, they really, in a sense, had it made. They got it right. And of course, then this all blew apart. And yet you say that the key is forging a new middle class dream of the future for Kenya. So is that likely to happen?
Well, what's happening here, to be very honest, is that we have a population that is 80% youth, below the age of 34. We have 80% of Kenyans are employed by the informal sector, not by the formal sector. So this is a condition where, to be very honest, we have fundamental underlying realities that unless we wake up to, we in the middle class face the danger of being dragged out of our nice cars and out of our pretty homes in our nice neighborhoods by a huge bulge of young, unemployed, mainly male, angry Kenyans who felt a sense of tremendous liberation and empowerment by the violence that took place in 2007 and 2008.
Why did they feel that sense of liberation?
Because, unfortunately, violence is tremendously empowering to young people, especially to young people who are unemployed, don't have a sense of the future, feel a sense of helplessness and hopelessness about their prospects for the future. And then they're able to organize organically in a quite a chaotic way into little gangs that can extort money from the public, first of all, extort from each other, from the poor predating on the poor. But eventually they begin to realize that they can, you know, they can set up roadblocks and shake down the middle class, shake down the rich. And we put up higher and higher walls to protect ourselves as better off Kenyans. Mm. But we are a smaller and smaller minority. And this group of the poor is growing at the rate of 1 million per year.
Yes, that is, 70% of Kenyans are under the age of 30, and a bit over 40% are under the age of 15. So that is an extraordinary figure. Is this a tribal affiliations still cutting through with young people, or is this cross tribal?
It is. It's a mishmash. It's all Kenyans carry multiple identities. Majority of Kenyans speak at least, you know, two or three languages. We carry multiple identities. Violence has a tendency of attenuating the ethnic identity. It's a wonderful place to retreat to, especially when you're faced with threats to your property and to your life. And so it has the politics of identity, of ethnicity, of religion, of clan, have gained a currency that is more compelling now than it was, say, 15 or 20 years ago. And that is a dangerous thing. It is a dangerous reality in Kenya in this kind of democratic context. But, you know, I always say that we as Kenyans have faith in democratic processes. It shows that Kenyans, especially the youth, continue to have faith in democratic processes, which is a good thing. And all that Kenya has, which is important, is Kenyans. We don't have oil. We don't have gold. We don't have any of those other extractive industries that have caused so much trouble for many of our fellow African countries. And I am, you know, extremely grateful for that. I think, you know, the worst thing that could happen to Kenya right now is for us to strike oil.
You've just got lions and the big five, the fabulous, you know, your fabulous animals and so on. But do you think there has been a sense of confidence restored in Kenyan nationhood? In this context, what do you think is the most pressing reform needed? What's a first priority?
I think the first priority is, first of all, the constitution has been put in place, and implementing it step by step is important. But critical to that is ensuring that we have the machinery to conduct what will be an enormous and highly complicated election in 2012. I think that's extremely important. Number two is to have a coherent and effective security apparatus that enjoys the trust of the Kenyan people to be able to mitigate the antisocial expressions of unhappiness that may explode from here to there and may threaten to get out of control. So I think that's, even for me, even more important than some of the more technical sort of reforms.
I mean, do you feel more or less safe yourself? You're a Kikuyu man, and you really were one of the elites, and you grew up in a lovely house in a very nice suburb and so on and so forth. Do you have friends across tribal groups? Do you specifically seek that out? I mean, what's your commitment to this new Kenya?
Well, I do. I specifically seek it out, and I enjoy it. I mean, partly because of my history, I'm able to be treated as a Kenyan. People will say, "Yeah, this guy's a Kikuyu," but well, his history shows that he's more of a Kenyan than he's a Kikuyu. And I like to think that many people think that. And for me, that's the kind of person I'd like to be. It doesn't mean that I don't take my own ethnic identity, that I'm not proud of it. But I'm just saying that I'm more proud of being a Kenyan and being an African and being a global citizen. I think we've got to think big. We've got to think outwards, not inwards.
Well, John Githongo, I do wish you luck And I hope that we may welcome you to Australia sometime to talk to us in person. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Nice speaking to you.
John Guthongo is director of Inuka Kenya. It's a grassroots advocacy organisation in Nairobi, and he was writing in Foreign Affairs magazine earlier this year. Now, we've got a couple of lovely letters Peter has written to us about banks. In 1962, I joined the Bank of New South Wales on a salary of £440 per annum. In that year, the bank made a profit of £750,000. Petrol was 3 and 6 a gallon. Butter was 5 shillings per pound. In 2010, Westpac's profit was $635 billion. All things being equal, the starting annual salary for a 15-year-old clerk would be $3.7 million. Petrol would be $350 a litre. Butter would be $1,075 per 500 grams. Thanks, Peter. And one from Dr. Glenn McLaren. I teach philosophy at Swinburne University and was an interested listener to your discussion on WikiLeaks. Like many, I'm fascinated with the Emperor's New Clothes effects of the leaks and the duplicity that's been revealed. I have a concern, however. A profound misconception has emerged and taken root regarding the evolution of complex processes. This is the belief that quality emerges from quantity. Quality emerges in nature from a finely balanced relationship between growth and constraint, or chaos and order. Quality will emerge from WikiLeaks through the creation of a dynamic balance between order and chaos by constraining the chaos generated by this mass release of information. Thanks, Glenn. And I want to do a big thanks to our team, Sarah Konofsky, heading off to Tasmania to edit the literary magazine The Island, Hagar Cohen, going back to Background Briefing, so look out for her work, and Rita Betancourt, very regrettably leaving us to take up other duties at home and here at RN. Julie Browning, I'm delighted to say, will continue to steer the ship with her usual skill and aplomb as executive producer. Thank you for your company. Have a wonderful Christmas. We'll be back next year. Bye-bye for now. It's 9 o'clock.